That's the New York Ska Jazz Ensemble with a different take, a roots rock reggae ska take on Dave Brubeck's Take Five. That's from their 2008 album, Step Forward. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. It is Tuesday, October the 7th, and we head straight to Detroit, where there are claims of light at the end of the bankruptcy tunnel. And, of course, we are joined by our correspondent, who has been keeping us apprised of what's going on in the courtroom, Abayomi Ezekwe. He is the editor of the Pan-African Newswire, and he has been following the trial, the bankruptcy trial. Abayomi, thanks for being with us again today.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
Well, what's going on? What's with all this stuff? The governor is saying that there is light at the end of the tunnel to the point where he says Detroit ought to be out of bankruptcy between 30 and 60 days. What does he know that the rest of Detroit doesn't seem to know?
Well, apparently he has a very optimistic outlook, and he has to have that because he's running for re-election next month. So he has to make it appear as if everything in Detroit is on course. But if you talk to the people on the street, if you talk to the working people who are employed by the city and retirees, homeowners, they're a lot more nervous. They're concerned about the future of their city. We're in a situation right now where objectively things are not improving, no matter how much public relations is being portrayed as journalism through the print media, the radio, as well as television. I think that people are worried that their future is going to be secure in the city of Detroit.
Well, this week, the trial took a decidedly accelerated pace, and the focus is on the lone major creditor, Financial Guarantee Insurance Company, which is holding out for a huge payout, and they're supposed to be dealing or trying to cut a deal with the emergency manager, Kevin Orr. What's going on with that?
They still do not have a deal with FGIC, and they are taking different angles at this whole process. They're challenging the whole notion that the plan of adjustment is fair to them and also feasible in regard to its implementation. They've also taken an angle that the artwork at the Detroit Institute of Arts was highly undervalued for the purpose of passing legislation in Lansing earlier in the year, the so-called grand bargain, which many of us call the grand theft bargain, where according to this plan, the state of Michigan, along with philanthropic foundations, will contribute money to ensure the success of the plan of adjustment. But yesterday, during the hearings, the final hearings for the city ostensibly has closed this case in the proceedings. When I say the city, I mean Jones Day Corporation, because they, in fact, are running the affairs of the city of Detroit. They questioned both City Council President Brenda Jones as well as Mike Duggan, the mayor, and they asked some very sharp questions of City Council President Brenda Jones about whether or not she had reviewed this huge document. We're talking about 1,100 pages in regard to this plan of adjustment. Also, they were questioning her about the $1.7 billion in supposed spending that the city will be infused with for infrastructural improvements over the next period. And the question is, as Duggan said during his testimony, that you know, the city has no control after bankruptcy over whether there's going to be a national recession, whether there's going to be cutbacks in state revenue sharing. Also, the real elephant in the room, of course, is the revenue generated by property taxes. And I was at a meeting last night of the Moratorium Now Coalition. Someone did a presentation indicating that well over 100,000 tax foreclosures could potentially take place between now and April of 2015. So,
how many was that, Abayomi?
Well over 100,000 tax foreclosures, meaning households and property that are owed taxes to the city of Detroit and Wayne County. It's up to 100,000 that could be facing foreclosure by April of 2015. Even if that's three-fourths or one-half true, it's still a big dent in the overall tax revenue that will be accumulated by the city of Detroit for next year and also going forward. The housing crisis is by no means over. However, they refused to acknowledge that there was even a housing crisis in the city of Detroit during this whole bankruptcy process. Jones Day fought against putting any mention of the foreclosure crisis, both in terms of mortgages as well as property tax foreclosures. And they refused to even acknowledge it as being a factor in the bankruptcy and the financial crisis in Detroit, or to acknowledge the increase in tax foreclosures going forward. Because if that revenue is not there, then how is the city going to stabilize and move forward?
But Brenda Jones, the city council president, also admitted, I mean, quite an embarrassing moment it must have been, that she had not read, was not at all familiar with this same plan that the emergency manager is trying to get through the court as a feasible and fair plan to get out of bankruptcy, that she had no idea what it was about, and yet she voted for it.
Yeah, well, that just goes to show that they're not working on behalf of the city of Detroit. They're working on behalf of Jones Day law firm, Governor Rick Snyder, and the banks and corporations who are really pulling the strings in this whole process. And I think it's really a major admission on her part, saying that she's talked with the department heads, but she really couldn't give any specific information on how the city of Detroit is going to implement such a plan under such circumstances. The judge claims he wants to be assured that both the mayor and the Detroit City Council supports the plan and is willing to implement it and believe that the plan is fair and feasible. Well, there's no way that the plan is either fair or feasible. And in my estimation, it cannot be implemented because the projection, the financial projections involved are not correct. They're far too optimistic, and there's too many variables that are not taken into consideration. The overall economy, even in the United States, is still extremely weak. And that also is not being factored into this whole process. So I think this plan is going to face serious problems within 6 months to a year.
I want to come back to the City Council President Brenda Jones. She is the president of the City Council of Detroit. She is one of the pivotal votes in getting this plan approved. She, in fact, has indicated that she approves the plan. The mayor himself also has said he approves the plan. The governor loves the plan. But on the stand yesterday, she could not answer a single question about what the plan really calls for. And therefore, where does that leave the people of Detroit with respect to a decision around Brenda Jones?
It leaves the rank-and-file people of the city of Detroit, those of us who live here, who work here, who may own homes or have apartments here, who want to stay here. It leaves us without any effective leadership in terms of the overall municipal structures in the city. There are outside forces that are calling all of the shots, who are making all of the plans and implementing those plans, and they could care less about the overwhelming majority of African Americans who live in the city of Detroit. And that's just the reality of the situation that we're facing. So I am not surprised at all that they have not thoroughly reviewed the plan of adjustment. It's just not surprising to me at all. They go along typically with everything that is put forward by the emergency manager, by Mayor Mike Duggan, who in fact is a corporate-oriented mayor. I mean, he's never, in my remembrance, done anything that is progressive or supportive of working people and oppressed people in this area. He was the previous CEO of the Detroit Medical Center. Under his tutelage, the Detroit Medical Center was privatized and sold to a private healthcare corporation. They have the same plans for the Detroit Water and Sewage Department. Now they've come up with a Great Lake Regional Water Authority. The whole issue of affordability, the notion that people are entitled to have running water in a municipal context in modern times was rejected by Judge Rhodes and his court in a landmark ruling just 2 weeks ago. So these are the developments that we're dealing with, and if this is the best that the bankruptcy court can offer, then this whole process has been an abysmal failure, because how can you have a plan that was not drafted by the mayor, was not drafted by the city council, had virtually no input by people within the city, the stakeholders in the city, the real stakeholders, and yet this plan has to be implemented by them. And even Duggan admitted that they were, he claims they were 10% along the way of rebuilding the city. I don't know where he got the 10% from, but he did say that he was concerned about income, tax revenue, but nothing was said about property tax revenue, and nothing was saying about the possible overall national economic weaknesses and further crises that had in the past have had a devastating impact on Detroit, and of course will also in the future as well.
Now, Financial Guarantee Insurance Company is holding out for a big payout, a better payout than the city is offering at this moment, and it wants cash and it wants real estate. Any suggestions so far, and has anything leaked out as to exactly what it has its eyes on, both in terms of the cash payout and the parcels of real estate that it hopes to put its hands on?
Yeah, there's been some offers for real estate and other revenue-generating potentials in the city of Detroit. But a lot of these negotiations have been in confidence through the mediation process in the federal courthouse. So it's really not clear exactly what the parameters of the discussions are. But they are holding out. Today is October the 7th. They wanted to be completed with the whole process, they had initially said, by October the 17th. Whether that's going to take place or not remains to be seen. It's highly unlikely they'll be able to wrap up a deal by that time and then have the judge rubber stamp it. There's also got to be, as well, a hearing on the still outstanding objections and motions related to pensioners and others who did not go along with the grand theft bargain and who are saying that key aspects of that bargain, particularly the annuity clawbacks and the tacking of nearly 7% of interest on those clawbacks, was not disclosed in the plan of adjustment. Now, there's some differences over whether or not it was disclosed or the means under which it was disclosed. However, the whole process in and of itself is flawed, and I think Judge Rhodes is concerned that this whole thing could fall apart in just a matter of months after theoretically exiting bankruptcy.
I want to talk about the judge, since you brought him up. It seemed, I mean, just reading and about how the trial is being conducted and the issues that have come before him, that he resolved in a very, to me, a very odd way. questions that he's asking would suggest that he himself is not well informed about all of the aspects of the bankruptcy trial that he ought to. We talked with Elena Herrada, who was saying that she's a member of the school board, who said that she knows that the judge has not been told about what the emergency manager is doing with the school buildings, that they're shutting them down and selling them off, that she didn't think that he knew that that was an actual practice that is ongoing right now. Is there a sense, I mean, in the last couple of weeks, particularly as this trial picked up speed, and especially after Cencora struck its deal with cash and real estate, you get a sense that Stephen Rhodes, the judge, is eroding here, and he is probably likely to just rubber stamp, as you said, is probably likely to rubber stamp this bankruptcy exit strategy that Orr has put before him. What do you read of the judge's attitude in this case?
Well, obviously he's leaning on the side of the banks and the corporations. He's heard a lot of testimony, so he can't say he does not know about all of these problems that exist under emergency management, problems caused by the banks, problems caused as a result of the lack of democratic practice in this entire process. But obviously his political leanings are towards right. And in that regard, it's quite obvious because of the rulings that he's put forward. For example, at the eligibility ruling, he said that the state constitutional guarantees for pensions could be overruled through the federal bank process. And, of course, that ruling has national implications because it's now starting to impact the bankruptcy process in Stockton, California. He said last week that under bourgeois law in the United States, there was no right to water or housing or food or education. Well, you know, we already knew that when we went into the class action lawsuit against the Detroit Water and Sewage Department that he was overseeing. That there was no right. So for him to restate that under this system, people have no basic fundamental human rights to water, to housing, to food, to education, and so forth, speaks volumes in regard to what his actual political orientations are. So I think he's demonstrated his legal and judicial bias towards this restructuring program in favor of the banks and the corporations, upholding this entire process of totally ignoring the democratic rights and practices of the people of the city of Detroit, retirees, homeowners, and many others who have filed hundreds of objections in opposition to this. And even though they've been many heard in the courts, he has essentially said that they had no merit, and that the only thing that has merit is and the capitalists, whatever they're willing to accept from the people.
All of this action is going on in the court. What is going on outside of the court? One of the parallel things that I'm picking up is that there is a movement of sorts that is burgeoning now for people to respond on a political level. How are Detroiters organizing on that front?
It's not clear because this is an election year, and the governor is running for re-election against a Democratic challenger, Mark Schauer, who a lot of people say they don't know who he is, and we don't see him in the city of Detroit. We know the commercials that are being run daily, all day on television say nothing about the conditions of the people in Detroit and Flint and Grand Rapids and Pontiac, Muskegon, Inkster, these cities that are inhabited by many African Americans in the state of Michigan. There's virtually no discussion about those issues. There's vague discussion about Snyder cutting $1 billion out of education during his first year. He's denied that. But it was common knowledge. It was reported widely in the media in 2011 that that's what he was doing, devastating education. He's also devastated the municipalities, cuts to civil servants, even firemen and policemen, and have all been devastated by his program. But I don't think the Democrats are doing an adequate job in raising the key economic issues that would motivate people to come out to vote. They were saying today in the media that Snyder's lead was increasing over Schauer. A couple of weeks ago, they were saying the race was at a dead heat. So we'll have to see. There's still almost another month to go before the actual election date. So we'll have to see. Things can change over a matter of weeks in politics. They can change drastically. So we'll have to see exactly what takes place. But the real issue is what are people in the streets going to do, what they're going to do in the communities in terms of independent political action against the water shutoff, against the imposition of austerity, and the cutback in actual municipal services, which are still going on. As we speak, they're talking about how things have improved in the city. But if you talk to most people, in Detroit, things have worsened since Kevin Orr has been in office over the last 19 months. And
so
of
as
course,
as we wrap up, what is going to be the high point, or what are going to be the high points of the trial for the rest of the week, you think?
Well, I guess the mediation with FGIC and Jones Day. The judge has stressed several times that he wants this resolved as soon as possible, but the federal, the Financial Guarantee Insurance Corporation wants more out of this whole process. They don't feel they've gotten enough out of the city of Detroit after all these years, and they want more. And they don't
appear to be. Their claim is that they are owed
$1.1
billion.
Suddenly, yes. Over $1 billion they're claiming they're owed by the people of Detroit.
Right.
Also, one last thing, Utrice. It came out yesterday in the hearings that the consultants now have taken $180 million out of the city. They said it was $130 million, and then it's been a $50 million cost overrun in regard to consultancy fees. And what are they consulting about, and what have they actually achieved still remains a mystery.
$180 million
in
consulting fees. And
yes.
The city is going bankrupt, and they're in
yes.
bankruptcies. Oh, my
yes.
God.
So you can see.
And Detroiters don't have running water.
Yes, they don't have running water. The buses don't run. The streets are deplorable. There are tens of thousands of vacant homes, commercial structures, abandoned warehouses and factories. That is where we are right now in the city of Detroit.
Well, we'll be, of course, checking up again on the trial through you, and I
yes.
want to thank you so much for being there and for keeping us informed. Thank you so much, Abiyomi, for being with us today.
All right. Thank you.
All righty. We'll take this break, and when we come back, we'll talk about lentils and life. You're listening to Lead Stories on PRN.FM. I'm Utrice Lead. As it happens, people who know me know, I always must have, it is a requirement, I must have a supply of lentils in the house. Got to. And anxiety set in yesterday when I was in the mood for some lentil soup, and lo and behold, no lentils. the girl had to go get some lentils. So after the program, I decided I'll go get some. I live in a community that is, it's changing, but it's a very pleasant community in that it is very diverse, and you get the sense that it had been a bucolic little enclave at one point. And then things, of course, the demographics began to change. A lot of Brazilians in my neighborhood, a lot of elderly seniors. It's a great mix. But it is now not that upper class or middle even class. It's working class and working poor. But people with a sense that they deserve better in life. And so they cling to standards. You know, it's that kind of a community. When I say that, I mean, you know, how people, I had an aunt in Trinidad, of all places. You know, I'm saying that because she was quite poor. She was married to a poor man, but she was so incredibly aristocratic and wore, even back in those days, wore stockings at home and her skirt with a kickback pleat in the back. And she was the very picture of aristocracy. And one of my favorite aunts always had something to offer you, always had cake, and was always very, very well appointed in her home, a very modest home. So that's what I mean. But people have a sensibility about life that just disregards the circumstances of their lives. On my way out, I ran into the man here who, I wouldn't name him, he takes care of the complex I live in. And you see him up early in the morning, you hear the clatter, and he's taking care of business at 6 in the morning. And it is because he's now in charge of 8 buildings, each with 16 units, by himself, plus the grounds. There's no additional staff. And he is such a very extraordinary man, very quiet, but very, very diligent, very dedicated to what he does. And he takes such good care. Very pleasant man. And I admire him so because he takes such great pride in his work. And I saw him on my way out, and I was leaving at about 2:20. And he had been at work since about 6 and still working. And I'm walking to the store. And I pass a van that came to a screeching halt because apparently the driver and somebody else in the van saw something of worth. And what was it? Well, they have a practice here called bulk pickup, which is, you know, big items that are not normal garbage that you can throw out in your regular garbage. There tend to be furniture and big items like that. They schedule bulk pickup days, and there were things out there already placed for bulk pickup. And they spotted something. And so they stopped, and it was a mattress. A mattress. They were loading up a mattress from bulk pickup and 2 mismatched chairs. And they seemed to be Haitian. And I said to myself, I wonder why. Why would people pick up a mattress off of the street? Are they recycling this? Is this something that they need themselves? What are the circumstances of life where people would stop and pick up an item of unknown use and origin something so intimate, you know, a mattress that you will be sleeping on, and it wouldn't bother you that it's coming from the street and possibly from people who, you know, whose hygiene habits and so forth. They're not even thinking about that. But I continued my walk. Oh, I forgot to tell you, as I left the house, I saw a neighbor downstairs, and he was sitting right in front of the mailboxes. There's a concrete kind of bench. And he was sorting through things. And I said, oh, I haven't seen you in a while. And we had that kind of talk. And he said, yes, I haven't seen you either. He said, you know, I've been going through these circulars, and there are quite a few good coupons if you want them. I have some myself already, but there's some extras that they put, you know, they put in your mailbox all these circulars from different stores and so forth. Wendy's, he says, is pushing its pulled pork barbecue sandwiches. Do I want a coupon for that? And McDonald's is running a special now on mini bundt cakes that will go with its coffee. He had some extra coupons for that. And Domino's Pizza is featuring a new pizza special. He had some extra coupons for that. I said, no, no thanks. But it crossed my mind. There he is, sifting through the circulars for coupons. A man who, when I came to live here, was gainfully employed and doing quite well, quite happy. And it didn't register, of course, his distress, but you can tell from the diligence of searching through the circulars for coupons that something was happening in his life. But I kept walking to the store for my lentils. The store that I went to has an interesting kind of history, it turns out, in South Florida. It's Winn-Dixie, it's called. I don't like the name Dixie, but there we are. And there's an interesting thing. The people who shop at Winn-Dixie tend to be working class, working poor, and predominantly people of color. For some reason, it seems that it turns out that way. The competition to Winn-Dixie is Publix. And Publix, you find mostly a middle class, middle income group or people, working class, but you don't find an as overwhelming a presence of people of color among their customers as you do at Winn-Dixie. Well, I shop at Winn-Dixie, and I shop at Publix. They're both close to me. But Winn-Dixie's closer. And I get into the store, and immediately there was a sense like it was a morgue. It was very cold. Even at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, after almost 2:30 now, and something hit me like a ton of bricks. There were more people walking around with Winn-Dixie uniforms than there were customers. And I said, you know what? Let me do my own little surveying here today. I'm just going to do my own surveying and see what's going on in this store. I counted 16 people. 16 people in the store. Almost as many customers as the workers. One older woman was sampling a meal because she had been enticed. There were chicken wings they were trying to get people to buy because apparently they'd made so many of the chicken wings, but they were not moving. And she sat at a chair. They had those summer chairs that were still on sale. And she decided that she was going to relax and have herself some free wings. And then with a wink, she says to me, you know, I could keep this up, I'll have lunch. But she wasn't kidding. An elderly couple, I would say they're in their 60s. I picture them to be. The man is wearing an outfit, a white shirt, white pants, of a painter, and speckles still with paint. And I can hear him and his wife talking as they reached into the fresh vegetables area. And we're talking about sancoche, making sancoche or sancocho, as some people call it, a soup with calabaza. And she says to him in Spanish, well, it would be nice, but they want 59 cents a pound for calabaza. Over there, there's 5 pounds of potatoes on sale for $1.98. Maybe we get potatoes instead. But I'm headed for my lentils. And I get to them. And I grab a pack of lentils because, you know, victory is mine now. It's just me and my lentils. And then I realized it felt a little funny. The package just didn't feel like a package of lentils. And I looked closely. And a very interesting thing has occurred. They no longer sell one-pound packages routinely now. You have to look for the one-pound package of lentils. What you think you're buying as a one-pound package of lentils is actually 12 ounces of lentils. And they're all doing that. All of the brands are now packaging 3/4 of a pound and selling it at the per-pound price. And I said, my gosh, it's lentils. You know, you can get 200 pounds of lentils for a dollar. What is this thing? What is this reason for, I mean, chintzing on lentils? What is the point? Who in their right mind would want to buy 3/4 of a pound of lentils? If you want to say, okay, for some people, a pound of lentils is too much, well, all right, then say we have the 8-ounce package and then we have the 16-ounce package. But no. The intent here was to rob the consumer. It's 4 measly ounces, but it matters. Because what they're doing is they are expecting that consumers are not going to look. It looks like a pound, but it's really 12 ounces of dried lentils in the package. And you're buying them thinking you've just bought a pound of lentils. And it got me so angry. I couldn't contain myself. I said, you know, why? Why do these things happen? What is the point? How much more money could a company make? Maybe they make a heck of a lot of money giving you 12 ounces and you thinking you're getting 16. But you know, right then and there, I felt so taken advantage of, conned and hoodwinked by some stupid company someplace that is depriving me and getting a big fat joke about it of my 4 ounces of lentils and charging me still at the old rate of the per pound price. Well, so I had to look for a real pound, a real full pound, and there weren't many packages of real full pounds of lentils. I get to the checkout, and guess what? An item that I had, which was discounted, I picked up a discounted item, It was for $1.12. And it rang up as $4.29. And my habit is, before I leave any supermarket or any place, I always check my receipt. And I spotted the error right there. And I had to go to the service counter. And all these things had to go on. It had to go and check, and it had to get this number and this SKU number and blah, 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 blah. Bottom line is, after robbing me of my 4 ounces of lentils, their register was trying to rob me of $3.17 on an item that rang up the wrong price. So I left. I got my $3.17, and I left the store. And I'm fuming because it just seems so wrong. It just seems this lentil thing. I'm going to start a war on lentils. It just seems so wrong that they're doing this, and they're doing it without telling the consumer. You know, we're changing the packaging. What they've done is they've just made it look like a pound, but you're really getting 12 ounces of lentils, and you're still paying the per pound price, so you're paying more for less. Fun thing, great marketing technique, but in the end, you're being had. And you know, while I was fuming, still walking on my way home, about thinking about my lentils and my lentil soup, I get a call from a friend of mine. We've been friends for more than 25 years. We talk all the time. And she said, "Did you get your blessing today? Did you get your blessing yet?" I had no idea what she was talking about. I said, "Well, she says, "I mailed it. You should be getting it today." I said, "Oh, what is it?" She says, "I can't tell you. It's a blessing." And I get home, and sure enough, at my front door is a tiny little box, but heavy for its weight. And heavy for its size, I should say. And I picked it up and opened it once I got in. Of course, I set my lentil soup up before I opened the package. And I opened it up, and there is a scarf, because she knows I love scarves, a nice scarf. And there is a kurta I wear. There's a Pakistani outfit. It's just cotton, plain cotton, two-piece cotton that Pakistanis wear. And I find them so comfortable because I use them for everything. I wear them in the house. I wear them around the community. I even have worn them at a funeral, my brother's funeral. I wore one, just needed to be comfortable. It was great. And peanuts, bags of peanuts, because she knows I love peanuts. So I called, I said, "Hey, I got my blessing. What a great gift to walk in and get this package. A strange combination of things." She says, "Well, you get a blessing because I got a blessing." I said, "Really?" She said, "Yes. A young woman that when I lived in Brooklyn, a group of us, we kind of adopted this young girl, young woman now, a mother now, with children of her own, from Ghana, and pooled our resources, whatever it is we had as resources, but she was the chief organizer of this effort, and put her to school, put her through school. She's now a pharmacologist and living in Wales, and the mother of two children. And we even organized her wedding and got all of her relatives here to witness this wedding. Anyway, She said, well, she sent me a check and said she was just thinking of me, and she sent this check as a blessing. And so that is what redeemed my day. That in Obama's America, in this so-called prosperous time that we're living in, where people are catching hell and unraveling very quietly, the saving grace really is about people caring, genuinely caring about each other. But there's no question that people are catching hell, and we're all in it, in one way or the other. There's no reason that the maintenance man of this complex should be up working at 6 o'clock in the morning till way past reasonable hours in the afternoon every single day. There's no reason that people should be pulling mattresses off the street, not caring what kind of health risk that they are taking. There's no reason that a man and his wife can't enjoy a good, healthy bowl of sancocho with pumpkin in it and have to settle instead for what's on sale. There's no reason an elderly woman is banking on samples for her lunch of chicken wings. There's no reason that I should be living without my 4 ounces of lentils when I am paying for a pound. There's no reason for any of this to happen, but it's happening every single day to hundreds of millions of people. And we hear word about how great things are, the great prosperity that is occurring. Haven't you heard? Aren't you enjoying prosperity right now? And these are the daily assaults that are going on, the indignities to people's lives, the choices that they have to make that they shouldn't have to make, not in today's America. They shouldn't have to deprive yourself of a piece of pumpkin in your soup because you can't afford 59 cents a pound. And with great dignity, my friend, culling through coupons for rotten food that won't do a body good at all. But in all these ways, our lives are unraveling in Obama's America. Everybody has a version of it. But in the end, the saving grace is that hopefully there's somebody who cares enough to send you a blessing or to be a blessing in your life. And in turn, to expect that you would continue the chain and be a blessing in somebody else's life. And that's the story of lentils and life in Obama's America. I want to thank you for joining me today. It's always a pleasure being with you. I take great pride in it and great joy. Coming up next is The Infectious Myth with David Crow. You can reach me at leadstories@gmail.com or on Facebook, Lead Stories with Eutrice Lead. I'll tell you more about programs coming up next week when I hope to be in New York, God willing, if the creek don't rise. But until then, stay tuned and do promote PRN and your very favorite program here. A pleasure, as always, and a great, great privilege to be in your company. Bye-bye.